you work, you have to really believe the place that you work in is the best possible place to work. His wife had divorced him because he was so obsessed with listening to Five Live. I remember my first few months just feeling like such a fish out of water.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moments series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Louisa Compton.
I was born in Suffolk, but spent most of my childhood in Bedfordshire with my mum and younger brother Tom. My father left when I was two and he wasn't really present in my life. So a lot of my childhood, we lived in the country. I seem to remember spending most of my childhood playing in fields. We had loads of hens and ducks and geese, sheep, as well as dogs and cats. So it was very much a country upbringing. My mum tells a story about me when I was at primary school, crying every Sunday before I'd go back to school for a period. And she would ask, you know, what was the matter? And it turned out that I was really nervous about a spelling test I'd have every Monday. And my mum went to the school because she thought, you know, it's outrageous. There shouldn't be so much pressure on my daughter. And the school said, oh, I don't know why she's worried. She always gets 10 out of 10 in the spelling test. But I'd really put a lot of pressure on myself to always want to do well at school, certainly in my early years. But I do remember one summer, my brother and I set up our own radio station. And we lovingly recorded onto tapes and we'd make up our own stories between the links playing records. And I think that was my first ever glimpse of working in radio, although I dread to think how awful we must have been. Thankfully, those tapes were very quickly recorded over. And my mum was a Radio 4 obsessive. She always had it on in the background. And I used to find it utterly annoying. I hated listening to Radio 4, especially the dramas where everyone spoke in a plummy voice. It just felt utterly unrelatable to me.
Won't you tell me what is troubling you?
It's nothing, Mother.
You used to come and tell me all your troubles.
As I became a teenager, I began listening to the radio properly. And I used to listen to Radio 1 all the time. I remember I was obsessed with the Charles show. It was such a big deal back then.
It's great to be back with the UK.
Pretty much anyone my age, I think, had a notebook and I'd write down the top 10 into it each week. And like everyone else, I'd painstakingly record my favourite song from the radio, be really annoyed when I missed the beginning of a second or two of the song. And the Radio 1 era that I listened to was Simon Mayo and Nicky Campbell, and they're both two people I later worked with at Five Live. Actually, thinking about it now, that lineup was so male back then. I think all the presenters on Radio 1 were men. So I spent a lot of my youth listening to Radio 1. And then somehow I stumbled upon Talk Radio when it first launched. I remember listening to it on the day it launched. And that's when I think I really started getting into Talk Radio. I'd listen to it every night. It would actually be what I listened to send me to sleep. And I still find I sleep better when I've got speech radio on in the background. And I remember listening to Talk Radio. I think it was Ian Collins or James Whale. And I remember hearing an interview on the programme, and then that same interview that I just heard would appear in the news that hour. And obviously that happens all the time in radio, but that was the first time I'd heard it. And I remember thinking, wow, I've just heard that interview and now it's made it to the news.
Hello.
Oh, good evening. I'm sorry to disturb you. I can see you're either having your tea or you're enjoying yourself.
Well, you are an observant chap. Yes, I am. And yes, I've been working all day. What do you want?
I think I had all sorts of career thoughts. I thought about being a vet. I thought about being a solicitor and probably anything else in between. I certainly didn't know I wanted to be a journalist then, but I do remember one event, which probably at the time didn't feel significant, but looking back, definitely was. I was always interested in news, and I would always want to, unlike a lot of teenagers, I would always want to watch the news and steal my mum's paper and read that. And I think unconsciously my decision to become a journalist probably stemmed from the day that Margaret Thatcher resigned as Prime Minister. I think I must have been about 13 or 14. And I was off school ill that day, and I remember watching it as it broke on the lunchtime news.
Mrs. Thatcher is to resign as Prime Minister. A short while ago, Downing Street confirmed she's to step down and will not be contesting the second ballot for the
leadership. And it was, you know, obviously a huge story. I'd grown up most of my entire life with Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister. And I remember thinking, I'm going to ring my mum, who was at work, and tell her. Pre-mobile phone, so I called her landline and spoke to one of her colleagues and told her first of all, and then she passed the phone to my mum and I told my mum. And I distinctly remember the thrill that I got then at breaking some news. Obviously, it wasn't my news to break, but I was a person telling them both that significant piece of news. And I don't think I've ever really lost that thrill. You know, I want to tell people about things they don't know. I want to reveal stories. I want people to say, wow, to a story of mine. And I think my concept of journalism as a teenager was always about people who go to great lengths and risk their lives to reveal the truth. And somehow that always appealed to me.
There's Douglas Hurd, the Foreign Secretary. There are strong suggestions that he might take over, but we don't have any information about that at the moment.
I didn't really do much. I kind of messed around after school for a period. I didn't go to university. And then when I got to about 21, I thought, I really need to do something with my life. I need to sort myself out. And at that stage, suddenly, being a journalist kind of suddenly hit me that that's what I wanted to do, although I had no real journalism qualifications or anything like that. And I wrote to my local newspaper and asked if I could do some work experience with them. And ridiculously, given I had no journalism qualifications, but they said yes. And my first day there was straight out of the journalism cliche book. A reporter had just got back from holiday. I think he was in Croatia or Yugoslavia, as it may have been then. And he brought in with him a huge bottle of spirits. And he poured everyone in the office a glass of spirits at 9 a.m. And everyone sat there drinking alcohol, which I've never been in a newsroom where that's happened since. And in my first week as work experience, I got sent out to cover a story about a monster Leylandii bush that was blighted a neighbour's life. And I just didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue how to write the story up or how to present it. I remember writing my initial article and the Saab or the editor coming in and changing it and adding the word monster into the title. I also remember being asked to write letters to the editor back then because I was told they didn't get any real letters, so we had to make up some letters to the editor to be published in the paper. And while I was there, they introduced me to a local radio reporter at Three Counties Radio. His name was Neil Roy, and they suggested I do some work experience with him. I actually wasn't that interested then in working in radio because I had some sort of noble concept that newspapers were, you know, intellectually far more superior. But I said yes anyway. Frankly, I didn't have anything else to do. And I'm not really sure that monster Leylandii bushes were in any way more superior. So Neil Roy took me under his wing and I did work experience with him for a couple of weeks. And he would set me homework every night. It would either be to practice reading voice reports or he'd set me homework about local knowledge. Go away and tell me 5 facts about the A6 murderer, James Hanratty. He was based in a regional office in Bedford, and he took me to the main headquarters of Three Counties Radio in Luton. And I did a day, I spent a day there. And initially I was given some, you know, meaningless jobs like photocopying and making tea. And then I think the day that I was there, I think Paddy Ashdown must have resigned as leader of the Liberal Democrats or a similar story like that. And suddenly it was all hands to the deck and I was asked to start fixing some MPs. And I knew quite a bit about politics, and I think I made a bit of an impression with them and managed to obviously fix some MPs who came on air and reacted. And the next day, one of the people who worked on that programme was involved in a car crash and was off work for 2 weeks. And I got asked if I'd come back and cover behind her for 2 weeks. And I never looked back. And I absolutely fell in love with radio when I was at Three Counties. I just couldn't believe how intimate and how instantaneous it was. I couldn't really comprehend how I could call someone up on the phone and then they'd be live on air in within minutes. It really blew my mind. And I think from that first day, I just felt like I'd found my calling and found a home in radio.
News, talk and entertainment for Beds, Hearts and Bucks. This is BBC Three Counties Radio.
Well, I can remember the building so vividly. It was next to a dual carriageway in Luton, really in the centre of Luton, opposite an insurance, the headquarters of an insurance company. You could smoke back then. So we had, obviously you didn't smoke in the office, but there was the stairs were the smoking room where, you know, lots of people would have serious conversations over a cigarette. It was a tiny workforce. Obviously, I think the whole station probably had maybe 30 people working on it. And some of the people I worked with back then, 20 odd years ago, are still there. And they're actually still some of the people I'm still really in touch with and count some of my closest friends. But it was a great place to work because I think I joined at a period where there were lots of other people my age who were just starting off in their first jobs in radio. And there was a group of us who really bonded, and we were all so hungry to succeed and to do well. A great place to soak up loads of information and to also make your mistakes. I think now, whenever I meet people who are keen to start off in the industry, they often want to start, you know, start somewhere really glamorous. And I always say, spend some time in local radio or local TV or local newspapers, and that will be the best training ground you can get. It's where you can make mistakes. It's where you can learn. You feel a different sort of pressure. I mean, I definitely made mistakes at Three Counties. And I think I made some horrific mistakes, but also just learned so much there. Not just about the area itself. We covered Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire, but also about journalism and about telling stories and about painting pictures on the radio.
Well, that means quite simply Rupert Murdoch is sacked or closed down the wrong red top, hasn't he? This is a bit like...
So for a period I worked with a presenter called John Gaunt, who used to present the breakfast programme at Three Counties Radio. He was notoriously difficult and could be difficult, but always had a somewhat sweet spot for me, and you know, always said he was excited by me because he felt like I was like a dog with a bone and I'd never give up on a story. And one day I was setting up the breakfast programme, and there was a story, it's a classic local radio story, about a black cat that had been seen or spotted, I think it was in Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. And so, of course, I try and fix a black cat expert to discuss this said sighting of a black cat. And I went through our contacts and found a black cat expert whose name I will never forget. It was David Tomalax. So I fix him up and I fix several other people for the next day's programme. And the next morning I'm in bed listening to the breakfast programme because I didn't have to come into the office till later on. And I hear this interview, and as it unfolds, it becomes more and more of a car crash. It becomes quite obvious this guy doesn't particularly know what he's talking about. And John Gaunt, I think, calls him out and says, "What kind of black cat expert are you?" And the guy says, "What's my name?" And John sounds really confused and said, "Oh, David Tomalax." And he says, "Yes, that's Scam-a-lot, Scam-a-lot backwards. You've just been had," and hung up the phone on John. And this is all on air. And I'm just in bed thinking, that's it. I'm going to be sacked. I'm never going to work again. I felt physically sick going into the office. But as this is unfolding on air, John then says, I mean, it's unbelievable to say now that all this happened on air. But John said, "Who set this up? Who fixed this interview? When I find out who fixed this interview, you will not have a job." And you can just imagine, I was 21, 22, my first big job. I'd suddenly found a profession that I fell in love with and thought, that's it, my career's over. But of course, by the time I came into work, it was John who'd been told off for being so unprofessional on air. And, I don't think I ever really got in trouble for it. I think I was given some great advice early on in my career at Three Counties, which I always try to remember. One was, wherever you work, you have to really believe the place that you work in is the best possible place to work and really love it, which I've always done throughout my career. Second bit of advice was, make yourself indispensable. And again, that's really good advice. And the third bit of advice is also related to another mistake, was I'd just done my first shift as a reporter on the breakfast programme. And I hasten to add, I've never wanted to be on air and never will. I'm much happier on the other side of the screen, as you can probably tell now. But in local radio, you have to do a bit of everything. So I was sent off one morning on a breaking story. And I literally cannot stress enough how at this stage, I knew absolutely nothing about journalism or how to be a reporter or anything. But nonetheless, I was sent out on a story. No doubt it was an absolute disaster. And when I got back, I think I had the same conversation in my head that I would never work again. So I went to see my boss, a guy called Mark Norman, and said to him, "Look, I'm really sorry. I want you to know I will work so hard to make sure I'm better and I improve and I never do a report like that again." And he said, "Louisa, as long as you always work hard and strive to be better, then I'll always be happy. The minute you think you can do no better is the time you should give up." Now, years on, looking back, I realised he probably never even heard my report and he was just throwing some platitudes my way. But I really held on to those words in my career, always kept that mantra going that I just, as long as I just work hard to improve myself and never stand still, I'll be okay. I think early on in my career at the BBC, I was just so amazed to be working there. I was really kind of reverential and in awe to it. I couldn't quite believe that someone like me was working at the BBC. And that stuck with me for the early part of my career. It just felt like an organisation that other people worked at, that I remember everywhere I'd go and I'd meet new people and I'd say I worked at the BBC, you were really treated as though you were very, you know, people, it was like, oh, wow, the BBC, which I don't think happens now for all sorts of reasons. But at the time, I just felt so lucky to be working there. I think I stayed at Three Counties for way too long, really. I think I joined in about 1998 and left in 2004, I think. And I stayed there partly just because I was loving it so much and had so much fun, and partly because I probably didn't think anyone else would want me. But then, for various reasons, I ended up getting some shifts at Radio 5 Live, which was then based in Television Centre. And I remember the first time I walked through those doors at Television Centre, it was such a pinch me moment. And I remember seeing Jeremy Paxman, who obviously I would watch on Newsnight most nights, and he was such an icon. And a random children's TV presenter, I have no idea who it was, but I recognised him. Again, it was just one of those, wow, I really felt like I'd made it in some little pathetic way, that I'd really made it just by being in that building with, you know, with those kind of people working in my vicinity. And the longer I worked at the BBC and the more confident I grew, the more I, you know, saw its flaws and saw how it, you know, super serves a certain type of audience and doesn't necessarily represent all audiences and can be very old-fashioned and can be like a tank trying to move it. But in my early years, I was just so in love with working at the BBC and so proud. I really carried it as a badge of honour that I worked at the BBC.
Any idea how long M62 Junction 37 will be closed? Phone battery low. Wife due to have twins any time. Need to get home. Thanks, says a texter. Just check with Nick Duncalf, who says at least till 7 p.m.
I started listening to 5 Live when I was at Three Counties Radio, and I used to work on the breakfast programme, so I'd come home and listen to Drive with Peter and Jane, and it was just one of the best radio programmes at the time, I think. And I really started thinking, I wish I could work at 5 Live. And then one day a story broke about Luton, which is where Three Counties was based. And 5 Live got in touch with me, and I spent ages helping them out on the story, giving them background. I can't remember what the story was. And the assistant editor who I'd been helping, a woman called Catherine Norman, emailed me afterwards to say thank you and if I'd asked if I'd ever thought about working at 5 Live. And, you know, that was another can't quite believe it moment. So, you know, said I'd love to, and she offered me some freelance shifts. And I spent a couple of months working full-time at Three Counties Radio and freelancing for 5 Live at weekends. So I'd do earlys on Three Counties Monday to Friday and then come in at the weekend and do a night shift on Friday and Saturday night. I had absolutely no social life. I was knackered for months on end. But it was worth it for me to try and get a chance to work at this station that I absolutely loved. And I think I did that for, I'm not sure, maybe 3 or 4 months. And then I was offered a short-term contract for 3 or 6 months to cover on, I think it was a breakfast show initially. And I was so convinced that it would just, after I'd spent 3 or 6 months there, that I'd end up going back to Three Counties. So I refused to have a leaving party. I insisted that no one made a fuss of me when I left Three Counties because I'd be coming back in a few months. And of course, I never did go back. And I stayed at 5 Live for, I think, again, quite a long time, 10 or 12 years. And I rose up quite quickly. I started as a BJ and then became an SBJ and then an assistant editor and then an editor. And I started working on the breakfast programme with Nikki Campbell, who I used to listen to many years ago when I was a teenager on Radio 1. And he presented the breakfast programme with Sheila Fogarty.
5 Live News, 6:47. 5 Live News? What am I talking about?
Well,
5 Live Breakfast.
Part of the whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, news, breakfast,
sport.
You name it, it's here. Police are crossing... are you done?
Yeah.
So am I. Police are crossing...
And again, in much the same way as Three Counties made me fall in love with radio, 5 Live made me, you know, fall in love with news radio. And just, again, the thrill of a story happening and being able to respond to it so quickly and so kind of effortlessly, I just felt I'd found my home. I think I worked on every program at 5 Live apart from Late Nights and Up All Night. I worked with Peter and Jane on Drive for a period and absolutely loved them. And then when I became the assistant editor, I started working with Victoria Derbyshire on her programme. And I was the assistant editor there for about a year before I became the editor. And I think occasionally in life you get to work with someone who you just click with. She's now become one of my best friends, but as colleagues, I think we clicked really early on. We both got really excited by the same stories. We both came alive over the same story. We both wanted to push ourselves and each other to work harder. And in our time together, working together, we covered some absolutely amazing stories and travelled to some fascinating places.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hello, good morning. It's 10 o'clock Wednesday morning. This is Victoria Derbyshire on 5 Live with the latest news, sport and interviews between now and noon. This morning, your opportunity to speak to the Justice Secretary, Jack Straw, one of only three people to
serve. I actually started managing people when I was at Three Counties Radio, just in that I would manage one person when I was the breakfast producer then, and I would manage a person on next day. I never really thought at that point in my career that I wanted to be a manager. But what I did know was I loved developing people and I loved seeing people grow. And I remember at Three Counties Radio, a young reporter wrote me a letter telling me what an impact I'd had on his life and how I'd really helped him grow in confidence and helped him, you know, realise his dreams of being a reporter. Vividly remember getting that letter and feeling really proud that I'd made a positive difference on someone's life. And although I never set out to be a manager, as my career went on and at 5 Live as I became a manager and I became an assistant editor at a really young age. I think I was the youngest assistant editor at the station. I was definitely then the youngest editor. People had warned me, oh, I think you'll find some people will be quite difficult to you because you're so much younger. And I never really found people were difficult to me. And I think that's because I always try to treat people with respect and value people and get the best out of people. And I'm sure I've made some awful mistakes as a manager, but I always wanted to treat people how I would want to be treated. And for me, that was, you know, I wanted to be pushed and I wanted to be made to be the best version of me and to work as hard as I could. But I also wanted to try and make work as fun a place as it could be and to be able to have a laugh at times as well as work hard. I know that looking back at my career, I've got a better manager as time's gone on and I've realised the importance of having difficult conversations and preparing for conversations and really taking time to help develop people. But I think it was something I really enjoyed very early on in my career.
This is the UK's home of live news and live sport.
From the BBC.
5 Live.
It felt like it was a station that everyone was talking about, that had really got its mojo, that was kind of the impish younger sister or brother to Radio 4. And it may not be the truth, but it certainly felt like Radio 4 wanted some of what 5 Live had. Ultimately, I ended up being in charge of all the daytime programmes on 5 Live. So Victoria's programme, the lunchtime programme with Sheila Fogarty and the afternoon programme with Richard Bacon. And Sheila and Richard had also become great friends of mine and I'm still in touch with them. And that was such a great period of my life. But the kind of 5 Live I was trying to create was always one that was so people focused. It was tapping into its audience in a way that no other part of the BBC did. You know, it would cover stories the rest of the BBC wouldn't because they were important to our audience. And it wasn't obsessed with Westminster and it wasn't trying to, you know, it wasn't only covering highbrow stories. It was covering the kind of stories that people really cared about and that affected their lives. And it felt much more relatable. And that's what really made me tick. It was always in my career, at any point, I've always tried to give a voice to the voiceless and to champion people, and that frankly real people are often far more interesting than politicians or celebrities. I think I try to really empower our audience and their stories, and some of the best stories in my time at 5 Live were definitely stories that came from the audience or about the audience.
Hello Rachel.
Hello Victoria, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for coming on the programme. Tell us what's happening in your life today.
Today I'm just expecting somebody to come and pick me up to take me into an addiction stroke rehabilitation facility to try and conquer my problem. Well, not conquer my problems with alcohol, but try and cope with it.
The story that stands out most for me of all the stories we covered at 5 Live was a story with Rachel, an alcoholic doctor, who I still think about. She called into Victoria's programme when we were doing a phone-in about alcoholism, and she was drinking during that call. In fact, during the call, she asked her husband to pass her a can of Guinness, her third can of Guinness that morning. And she spoke so articulately and so eloquently and so searingly honestly about the power that alcohol can hold over someone. And I think it really showed so painfully that alcoholism can affect anyone and how people can still function with, you know, professional jobs like her whilst life is falling apart around you.
I'm a doctor.
Okay.
And a good doctor, I think.
She called in and we ended up extending the programme by 10 or 15 minutes because she called at the end of the programme and her call was so powerful. And the next day we spent the entire programme with listeners responding to her, and we had other calls from mothers who were also just about functioning and holding down jobs but addicted to alcohol. And I remember one mum the next day called in and said, I thought it was just me. I, you know, take my child to school, I make myself look presentable, and then I come home and I pour my first glass of wine at 9 in the morning. And it really shone a light on a topic that's so often presented in a judgmental way or in a stereotypical way. And Victoria and I kept in contact with Rachel. I would call her quite regularly after that call, and we became really invested in her life, both on air but also off air. And she went into rehab not long after that call, and I would speak to her partner John. She had a daughter as well, and they would update me on how she was doing. And then finally, after she'd been out of rehab for a period, she was ready to come on air and do an update. And we followed her for a period of time, and she kept coming on the program and doing updates, and she'd talk about the battles with staying sober and how alcohol is always there in the background. And she told a story about how her husband had once called the police on her for drink driving. She told stories about how she was able to function at work as an anaesthetist whilst also drinking. And listeners really connected to her. At that point in my career, I'd never known a story where listeners just connected to a person so much. And years later, people would mention to me Rachel the alcoholic, and they'd ask how she was, or they'd say they remember where they were when they heard that call. It was so powerful. And Victoria and I kept in contact with her, as I say, both on air and off air. And then one day we got a call to say that she'd relapsed for a short period over an Easter weekend, and she'd stopped drinking and she'd died in her sleep. And it was horrific and it was heartbreaking and it was such a cruel loss. Victoria and I went to her funeral, and that was maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and I still think about her often.
This morning on the programme, we're going to share with you some very, very sad news. Rachel, our dear friend and a doctor and an alcoholic in recovery, has died.
The beauty about radio is that it can connect you to people in that kind of way, because you are transported into people's living rooms or bedrooms or cars or wherever you are, and people feel such connection with what comes out of those airwaves. I think radio encourages people to open up in a way that TV can and does, but not to the same effect as radio. Partly it's the anonymity, partly it's the fact that you know, it's just your voice, you don't need to use your real name, you don't need to say where you are in the country. And partly I think people think of radio as their friend. People will watch TV, and obviously the numbers of people watching TV are greater than those listening to radio at any one point. But TV is your companion. You switch the TV on and you're actively choosing to watch it, whereas radio is often there in the background, and it's a friend to people. And I think people feel those presenters are their friends in a really intimate way, and therefore feel that they can trust that station or that channel or that presenter with really intimate parts of their life. And I think part of that was also Victoria, obviously, who is warm and relatable and allows listeners to feel that they can trust her because she understood them and she cared about their lives. And actually, just as I was saying that, reminded me that we once had a caller ring up, I think he was called Trevor, who rang up to say that his wife had divorced him because he was so obsessed with listening to Five Live and to Victoria. And I think that caller ended up being in quite a lot of the papers the next day. But it was a classic example of how much radio can dominate people's lives.
first for breaking news and the best live sport.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Another story that jumps out that I was really proud of at 5 Live was an infamous interview we did with Ken Clark, who was then the Justice Secretary, who in that interview, he was trying to say that different forms of rape should be treated differently. And he tied himself in knots. And when Victoria asked, "But rape is rape, isn't it?" he answered, "No, it's not." And those three words ultimately cost him his job as Justice Secretary. And I think that interview happened right at the beginning of social media. And it was my first experience of seeing a story snowball in real time. I think that interview finished mid-morning and it just exploded. He was doorstepped as he left our interview in the studio from that interview by lunchtime. So an hour or so later, Ed Miliband was calling for him to resign. It was a lead story on every news outlet and front pages the next day. And I think that interview was a turning point in politicians probably ending up being more guarded with the media, because it just coincided with the advent of social media and kind of quick 24-hour news cycles. And I'm sure if it hadn't been that interview, it would have been another interview. But it was definitely a moment in time in which you could monitor a story in real time online as it was exploding in a way I'd never seen previously.
That woman could find the rapist back on her street in a year and a bit.
Well, the
it's
rapist
an insult
is,
to her.
The
isn't
rapist
it?
Is going to be back. It's a very light sentence for a year and a bit.
Yes, a rapist gets 5 years.
Rapist, don't you? Rapists get more than
hang
that.
Hang on a minute.
Easily.
5 years on average. Yes, they do, Mr.
Do
Clark.
They?
Yes,
well,
they
that,
do.
That includes date rapes, 18-year-olds with having intercourse
so
with
15-year-olds.
So if they plead
guilty.
Early on in my career, I stayed at places too long because I just loved where I worked so much. And I couldn't really imagine working anywhere else. And when I was at 5 Live, I think I got asked to apply for quite a few other jobs, but nothing really excited me or nothing, you know, I always remember that bit of advice I had early on in my career, only work somewhere that you feel really passionate about. So I just was happy to stay at 5 Live and I felt like I was really making a difference there. But ultimately, after you've been in a job too long, you do start being restless and you do start thinking about where else you want to work. And I was asked if I'd consider applying for a job as editor at Radio 1 Newsbeat. And of course, I used to listen to Radio 1 all the time. I used to listen to Nikki. And one of the things I've always cared about is reaching underserved audiences and trying to not focus on those audiences that the BBC super serve, but focusing on the audiences that they don't necessarily. Newsbeat does that. And I really cared about trying to reach young people through news. And I did a bit of research and it just felt like a really exciting job. So I applied for that job and luckily enough got it. So I joined Newsbeat, I think in 2014. And again, felt so proud to work at that station. It's such, you know, everyone my age grew up listening to Radio 1 and Newsbeat. And it's got an amazing reach. Its bulletins were, you know, listened to by 8 million people. And it has a real power. It's a gateway for young people to the BBC. And if you, you know, engage your audiences at that age, well, then they'll stick with the BBC. So it felt like such an important part of the BBC.
Newsbeat.
Alex is 27 and has HIV. Today, Newsbeat's asked him to look into claims many teenagers don't understand how they could get the virus.
Does anyone know anything about HIV at all?
But when I joined Newsbeat, it was quite stuck in its ways. It had the most brilliant, talented, amazing members of staff, but it was very much a linear programme. It was very much a radio programme in what was then very much a digital age. 90%, 95% of its resources went on the radio. I came in and tried to really modernise it. I relaunched a website and put more resources into the website than onto the radio programme. Reshifted the focus to digital and to social. We started making films for the iPlayer, which Newsbeat had never done before. People hadn't made films, so I sent everyone, every member of staff, on a training course where they learned how to write for online, how to film, how to shoot, how to edit. It just felt like a really exciting period in my life where I was really able to make meaningful changes. And I think that's where I really learned how to be a manager and how to bring a group of people who were very used to doing work in a certain way, bring them with me, with my vision. And I changed the focus of the radio program so that we were telling fewer stories, but we were telling them better and in more depth. it obviously didn't ever assume too much knowledge, and it broke down stories really clearly. That was, it's a great testament to Newsbeat, and so many other parts of the BBC and other parts of broadcast media could learn from Newsbeat in terms of how they told stories clearly and accessibly for their audience of 16 to 24 year olds. But I was really struck when I got there that stories were told so quickly, because everything was about a young person's attention span, and therefore so many stories were told in 90 seconds. I was really struck. But actually, I think our audience is sophisticated enough that if we're focusing on the power of stories, and if we're focusing on people's stories, actually they can stick with us for a bit longer, and maybe we could tell those stories in an engaging way. But instead of trying to cram 12 stories into a 15-minute programme, perhaps we could tell fewer stories, 5 stories potentially, but give them a bit more depth, do a bit more explaining, but also put people at the heart of those stories. So we tried to do that when I was there. And I think I remember, because I'm such a nerd stat, I remember our AIs, which is the Audience Appreciation Index. I remember the AIs going up quite a bit after we made those changes.
So how many times were you in trouble with the police?
I've probably been in trouble over 100 times. Most of my offences are for fighting, criminal damage, stuff like that.
I mean, frankly, I always worked in places that the wider BBC management didn't quite care as much about. So therefore, I always had quite a lot of freedom. And I think when you've got your own freedom, the BBC can be as agile as you want it to be. No one above you is limiting you, or in most cases, no one above you is trying to limit you. So I think I was really lucky that I had a career at the BBC, and I did very well at the BBC, but I always worked in areas where I didn't feel cowed. But I think when I look at the BBC as a whole, it can be like turning a tank, and it can take time. And, you know, obviously it's such a hugely powerful and successful operation.
This is BBC Radio 1.
I've been at Newsbeat, I think, for about a year or so. So I hadn't been there very long.
Newsbeat.
When the opportunity to launch Victoria Derbyshire's programme on the telly came up, too good an opportunity for me to say no. When I worked with Victoria on the radio, I'd always wanted to make her programme on the telly. I just always knew it could translate. So when I was at 5 Live, I'd pitched it to BBC One and BBC Two, and I'd taken it to Sky, and they were all interested but never committed. And it goes back to that point I was making, I think, about Rachel the alcoholic, that I always felt that kind of intimate interview, there is nowhere like that on telly, and that there was no TV programme that would really afford time to tell interesting stories. And that's what I always thought, there was a gap in the market. So once, after I left, once that opportunity to launch the programme on the telly, or to launch a version of the programme on the telly, came about, I couldn't say no. So I didn't want to leave Newsbeat completely, because I felt such a loyalty to that team, and I felt such a sense of responsibility because I'd brought in all these changes. So I stayed on initially at Newsbeat as the executive editor. This brilliant editor, a woman called Debbie Ramsey, took over and has done the most amazing job at Newsbeat. But I effectively spent my time launching the Victoria Derbyshire TV programme.
Covering the news that matters to you, a lively new programme comes to BBC Two Daytime now as we join Victoria Derbyshire.
And it's probably the hardest job I've ever had in my career. We had no resources. We had a shoestring budget, and we had 2 hours a day to fill with original content, which is hard enough on the radio. On telly, it's so much harder. And unbelievably, we did it. We broke story after story. We won award after award, several RTSs and a BAFTA. And we really ripped up the rule book on conventional telly. I think coming from a radio background really helped me. There's a real snobbery, I think, in TV, which is very much, oh, if you've worked in radio, you can't possibly understand TV, and this is how we do things in TV. And it really frustrated me that people would say that to me. I mean, people still say it now, not necessarily to me, but I still hear people using those kind of snobbish terms about people in radio. And I really think it gave me an advantage, because I questioned everything. I remember those early meetings just before it launched, constantly being told, well, no, we can't do it like this. And I would ask, but why? And TV news is so conventional, and it certainly was then. And we really tried to loosen it up. We wanted it to feel intimate. We wanted it to have the best bits of the intimacy of radio mixed in with the impact and the kind of visual dynamism of TV. We tried to rip up the rule book as much as we could. We didn't want it to the studio to look like a traditional studio, which was a huge challenge given we were sharing a studio with Newsnight and Mar, but we wanted it to look like a space that Victoria could own. It's really mad to say it now, but at the time it seemed absolutely revolutionary that we would show Victoria walking from one part of the studio to the other, which is so utterly, so natural. But the TV convention then was we would cut away to something else and then she'd be sitting at the new desk. And that just seemed mad to me. Why not show her walk? We all walk from one place to another. That's a tiny example of just that every step we were trying to challenge things and trying to do things differently. And that might be the way we made our films. TVs, news packages are often very predictable. And I was trying to take the best of the kind of digital skills that I'd used and learnt at Newsbeat onto a linear TV program. And we tried to make our films look like they were made to work on YouTube or on digital platforms and to feel much more modern. We just tried to make a program that just felt much more conversational, really simple. So the presenter was talking to the audience, not at the audience. We really focused on wanting to represent modern Britain. So we wanted to make sure that our content, our team on air and off air reflected modern Britain and were meaningfully diverse. And we achieved that really genuine diversity both on and off screen.
Hello, good morning. It's Tuesday. It's 9:15. I'm Victoria Derbyshire and welcome to our brand new programme.
Again, this morning, on day one, our first day, we had a story that ended up the front page of the newspapers the next day. And I think that really set the record for my time there was that we were a programme that broke stories consistently and that covered the kind of stories you wouldn't find on the rest of the BBC.
When I started wearing girls' clothes to school, I felt much better.
At that stage, we're only talking about 5 years ago, but at that stage it felt relatively new to be talking about children who were transgender. And we followed two girls who were born boys. I think they were 5 and 8. We had been to interview them and to speak to their parents and to hear their story. And we'd worked with a clinic on the numbers of children under 9 who were going to that clinic to report that they were transgender. And I wish I could remember the figures, but I can't. But it was the figures were the story that became the front page story the next day. And obviously that just shows how much society has changed in 5 years. And now those kind of conversations about transgender issues are heard all the time on our radio and TV airwaves. But at that time, it felt very different to be having that conversation. The story that we broke in my time on Victoria Derbyshire TV programme that I will always be the most proud of was the footballer abuse story. We interviewed a man called Andy Woodward, who told us that he'd been abused for a period of years by his coach, football coach. He was a footballer, young footballer, by his coach, Barry Bunnell. And I remember him coming into the studio, and as with all the guests, I met him in the green room before he went on air, and Victoria and I talked to him about the interview. And I remember him saying to me, "Louisa, this story is big. Honestly, this story is huge." And he came on and he talked in graphic and harrowing detail about the abuse he experienced. The interview finished and he got in touch with us a day or so later and said, "I've had countless other people get in touch with me and say they too were abused by Barry Bunnell." And over the course of a week, we spoke to some of those other people, and obviously we stood up their stories and we checked them, and we persuaded 3 of the other men to appear on TV with Andy in a follow-up. That interview with Andy Woodward, Steve Walters, Chris Unsworth and Jason Dunford was the most, I don't even have the right words to describe how powerful that interview was. It was 45 minutes of TV with 4 grown men in vision detailing the awful, horrific abuse they'd experienced. They talked about being raped 100 times by their football coach, and you could literally hear a pin drop. And that interview opened the doors, opened a floodgate of people then getting in touch to talk about their own abuse, not just by Barry Bunnell, but by other coaches at other clubs. I think thousands of potential victims came forward. Hundreds of coaches were implicated. There have been criminal trials. A number of them have been convicted. A number of football clubs have carried out their own investigations into historical abuse. Laws have been tightened up. It exposed a real darkness in football in that period of 70s and 80s. It brought about a recognition that, again, a taboo subject of boys being talked about being sexually abused, it normalised it, and it allowed other people to come forward with their own stories, not just in football, but across different industries and across different scenarios. And we had so many people getting in touch saying, effectively, their lives had been saved by those interviews, that these were people who felt at rock bottom and didn't think life was worth living, and finally they were able to tell people, someone in their life, about the abuse they'd experienced.
Chris Unsworth says he was raped between 50 and 100 times by Bunnell at Manchester City and Crewe youth teams. He didn't tell a single person about the abuse for over 30 years until, in fact, he saw our interview with Andy Woodward last week.
That, to me, was why we wanted to launch that TV programme, because that was the kind of interview that previously you'd thought would only happen on radio. You know, 45-minute interview, people were gripped, and for all the right reasons. And that, to me, symbolised why it was right to bring that programme onto television. I was working at Channel 4 by the time the announcement that the programme was going to be cancelled was made. And I mean, personally, just so deeply upset, because it was a programme that I loved and it was my baby. You know, I'd launched it, I'd handpicked every member of staff on that team, I'd nurtured it, I'd put so much love into that programme. So I was personally devastated. I was devastated for Victoria and for the team of talented people working on it who believed in the programme so much. But I also just thought it was such a crazy decision that a BBC programme that reached a kind of audience that the BBC really should care about reaching, be it younger audience, be it a C2D audience, be it audiences from a diverse background. It had huge digital footprint. I think, you know, we would do a story that would be reached, one story would reach 26 million people on digital platforms. It was crazy numbers, because we were doing the kind of stories that were relatable to audiences and that they cared about. And it just felt like a really perverse decision by the BBC to want to close that programme. Of course, I know why. It's because BBC has to save a huge amount of money and it has to make difficult decisions. And it's easier to make a decision about a programme where the people who really care about it don't necessarily have a voice than to make a decision about a programme that politicians and in the industry itself watches or listens to. But I think it's a real travesty. I moved to Channel 4 just two and a bit years ago. I decided to leave. I think as I was approaching 40, I thought to myself, I'm at a crossroads now. I can either spend the rest of my life working at the BBC and I'll be a BBC lifer, or I can go out and I can find out more about a world outside the BBC. I was quite frightened about leaving the BBC because it was the only place I'd worked and I loved it. And I love the people there, and nearly all of my, or most of my friends are people I've worked with at various points in my career. And I just thought, I've got to face that fear. And if I don't leave now, I will stay at the BBC for the rest of my life. And the BBC isn't perfect, you know, no organisation is. But I wanted to work, I wanted to see what life was like outside the BBC. And the more I cared about current affairs and breaking stories and investigations and not just covering that day's news or the news agenda, but actually doing my own stories and doing my own investigations and, you know, holding power to account and revealing stories that no one else was covering. And we had such limited resources on the Victoria Derbyshire programme, there was a limit to our ambition. And, you know, I'd always say to people, it was always my motto, you've got to reach for the stars. And we would do that, and we pulled off some amazing stories with such tiny resources. But realistically, we could never do as much as I wanted us to do because we didn't have any money to spend. Then I realised that the editor of Dispatches at Channel 4 was coming up, and I just thought, this is what I want to do. I want to spend my time working on stories that make a huge difference. And I was really lucky. I went for the job, and I got the job. And I remember my first few months just feeling like such a fish out of water, not realizing how different Channel 4 would be to the BBC and, you know, stupid things, but every single system is different. The ways of working are so different. But I'm so glad I took that job. It's been so great for me learning about the commercial world and seeing how the commercial world works. And I grew up watching Channel 4. Channel 4 should have a natural affinity with me. It doesn't want to conform. You know, its remit is to make people think differently and to be edgy and to do, you know, really kind of public service journalism. I became the editor of Dispatches, I think, in June 2017 or 18, and had the best year there. And then in March this year, I was made head of news and current affairs and sport at Channel 4. And I got that job just at the beginning of coronavirus. So it's been a total whirlwind of a job. Initially, I think I was working till midnight every night for the first month. And we made 17 films on coronavirus in the first 3 months from our current affairs department, which is quite something. And I think we've made more films on coronavirus than any other broadcaster and reached some record audiences. And I'm really proud of our coverage of coronavirus. And of course, Channel 4 News has been absolutely flying. They, more than any other broadcaster, I think, have really early on were kind of questioning the scientific advice, questioning the government strategy, really kind of holding to account those decision makers. And I just feel, I'm aware that I've said this a few times in this interview, I always try to work somewhere that I feel I belong and that I feel like I have a home. And I feel like Channel 4 is a perfect home for me too.
Good evening. Can the price of a holiday abroad or a night at the pub be measured in COVID infections? It was holiday.
In the last few months, we've had the biggest story of any of our lifetimes, really, obviously in the shape of coronavirus. And it's been a story in which broadcasters have absolutely been relied upon. The entire country is more engaged in news than it's ever been or I've ever known it to be. And news programmes have had, across the board, have had record viewing figures. People have been really hungry for news. And we know both Channel 4 and also the BBC are really trusted by our audiences. And I think, you know, there will always be a TV audience who want to watch TV news programmes. I would say across the industry, we've responded really well to coronavirus, to Black Lives Matter, national conversations, which have really engaged the audience. I'm really proud to say that TV news feels in really good health. There are so many challenges, be it governments of the day not wanting to be interviewed or turning down interviews across programmes like Channel 4 News or GMB or Newsnight. But audiences are coming to us in record numbers, and that's got to be a good thing.
So help a rainbow out. Just be kind, people. Don't bust my balls over here. Yeah, I'm on a buzz. Rainbow that immediately. Channel 4. Lazy flipping slackers.
When I became a manager
coming through
at the BBC, I was really conscious that I would often be in meetings and I'd be the only woman in the meeting room. I would be really conscious that if I wasn't the only woman, I was certainly only in the meeting room with other women who also didn't have children. And I was also really aware that a lot of those meeting rooms, everyone in the meeting was white. I don't think being a woman has held me back in my career. I hope it hasn't. I'm also a lesbian as well. So there's two sorts of diversity here. I've never felt I've been directly at the end of any sexism or sexist decision making, either at the BBC or obviously not at Channel 4. But I've seen there is a glass ceiling for a lot of women. And I have no doubt that if I decided to have children in my life and if I'd gone on maternity leave, I think there would be a different set of opportunities. And I think that's a really difficult place that the industry's in. And I see in my job now that there are a lot of women freelancers, because the TV industry is predominantly built around freelancers. There are a lot of women who freelance as producer directors who, rightly or wrongly, do the brunt of the childcare and who find it really hard to work as a producer director because the lifestyle doesn't make that easy. And I think the industry has to keep having a long, hard look at itself and seeing what it's doing to support women better. And of course, it's having conversations now about how it can support better people from Black and Asian and other minority ethnic backgrounds. But I think the industry's got a long way to go before it really feels like it's an equal opportunity employee. It wants to be that. I think there is an absolute desire to change things, but a lot of meaningful change still needs to happen. I think there have been periods in my career, I'm so lucky that there have been periods in my career where I've been extraordinarily happy pretty much every job I've done. At Three Counties Radio, I was so happy just to be working in this industry. I just never quite got over that I had a job in radio. Then I moved to Five Live and I was incredibly happy there. My career really blossomed at Five Live. Then I went to Newsbeat. And then I launched the Victoria Derbyshire programme, and I was so happy that finally my dream of putting that radio programme on the telly had come true, and that we were doing all the things we thought we'd do. And I was again working with such an incredibly talented group of people who all bought into the vision and who all wanted to make the same programme that we wanted to make, and I was so happy there. And then I've come to Channel 4 and I'm working with a different group of really talented people and really able to kind of see my vision for current affairs on the channel be realised, and I'm so happy here. So I think I've been really lucky, or I've made sure that I've gone to jobs that I feel I can be really happy in, and that's a great place to be. I think a question like, how would you like to be remembered, is probably one not for someone like me who assumes that I will just be forgotten about very quickly. But I think if I'm remembered for anything, it would be really caring about giving a voice to the voiceless, really caring about people and wanting to fight for the truth and hold power to account and to tell more stories in the most kind of entertaining way.
Louisa Compton. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and if you like radio nostalgia, then do grab my book, won't you? It's called Radio Moments, and it's a very candid, very personal look at the last few decades in UK radio. That book is called Radio Moments. There's another one called Radio Secrets, which is techniques for podcasters and broadcasters. Loads of hints in there from some of the true greats of their art. So that book is called Radio Secrets. Both books available on Amazon, or check my website at davidlloydradio.com.